Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Carrier War by Irving A. Greenfield, writing as Roger Jewett, narrated by Sean Compton. Chapter 1. The klaxon aboard the CVL Shiloh screamed with an insistent, whooping cadence for 30 seconds, and the instant it stopped, the ship's general announcing system blared, "General quarters! General quarters! All hands, man your battle stations! All hands, man your battle stations!" Throughout the ship, men raced to their assigned stations. The clanging sound of watertight doors being slammed shut and dogged down could be heard until, finally, an eerie silence embraced the ship and there was only the pervading throb of her main engines to be felt. The pilots of Air Group 8 streamed into the fighter and torpedo squadron's ready rooms and hurriedly donned their flight gear. Moments later, the squawk box in the fighter ready room came to life, and an authoritative voice commanded, "Pilots, man your planes! Pilots, man your planes!" "Move it!" Lieutenant Commander Jacob Miller, Commander, Air Group 8, and Commanding Officer Fighting Squadron 8, shouted to his fighter pilots. He led the way from the ready room and headed for the catwalk ladder leading to the Shiloh's sun-drenched flight deck. The carrier was already turning into the wind, and the signal flags, F for Fox, were flying at the dip from the Shiloh's yardarms, indicating to other ships that the carrier was preparing to launch and recover aircraft. Jacob clambered into the cockpit of his Hellcat. With the help of his brown-jerseyed plane captain, he stowed his chart board, buckled his chute and shoulder harness, and connected his oxygen hose and radio line while plane handlers spread the aircraft's wings and locked them into place. "Stand by to start engines. Stand clear of propellers," the flight deck address system ordered. Once the air officer, surveying the scene from the open wing of the bridge, was satisfied with what he saw, he pressed his microphone button and ordered, "Start engines." Jacob thumbed his engine starter button. The propeller began to swing, and several seconds passed before the engine coughed and bursts of blue-white smoke erupted from the exhaust stacks on either side of the cowling. The propeller began to spin rapidly and the engine roared into life. He followed the hand signals of yellow-jerseyed taxi directors and moved into his takeoff position. The launch officer raised his right arm and, with a circular motion of his hand, indicated full takeoff power. Jacob pushed the throttle as far forward as it would go with his left hand, held it there, checked his instruments, and saluted, indicating he was ready to go. The launch officer dropped to one knee, extended his arm toward the bow, and touched the deck with his forefinger. "Take off." Jacob released the brake pedals, and the aircraft lurched forward. As it accelerated toward the carrier's bow, Jacob lowered his feet to the rudder pedals and felt the rudder begin to take effect. His plane lifted off the deck, cleared the carrier's bow, dipped slightly toward the sea, and as he eased back on the stick, it started to climb in a gentle right turn. He raised his flaps and retracted his wheels with a fleeting, grateful thought that he didn't have to crank them up by hand, as he had done earlier in the war. A quick scan of his instrument panel showed all readings normal.
"Red Leader, this is Red Rover," the Shiloh's fighter director called. "Do you read me?"
5 by 5, Jacob answered. He looked back over his right shoulder and saw his 12 fighters leave the Shiloh's deck at 20-second intervals.
"We have 6 bogeys bearing 090 true, 25 miles out, Angels 10. Stand by."
"Roger," Jacob answered.
"My guys are joining and I'm climbing to Angels 15.
Below him, the island of Okinawa appeared to be a large green patch in the expanse of the blue sea, crowned by towering cumulus clouds. From this height, the multitude of American ships off its southern coast looked like floating toys. For Jacob and the other pilots of Fighting 8, this was their third foray since dawn, when the first of the kamikaze attacks had begun. It was now 1600, and fatigue was Jacob's cockpit partner.
"Red Leader, Vector 090, 6 bogeys, Angels 8, 10 miles out."
Jacob acknowledged the order, and, turning to the heading, advanced his throttle to bring the Hellcat to near top speed. His wingman was tucked in on his right wing, and he could see the others close astern in his rearview mirror.
As he passed through 14,500 feet, he eased forward on the stick to level off. Suddenly he spotted in the glare of the sun three black specks below and ahead of him.
"Tally-ho, 12 o'clock low,"
he radioed to the other pilots. His adrenaline began to pump. He pushed the stick forward and dived. There was no doubt about it, Japanese aircraft. Within moments, he saw three more enemy planes above and to the left of the first group.
"Red leader," the Shiloh called. "Four more bogeys following the others about 10 miles back. Angels 10. Keep a sharp lookout."
"Roger," Jacob answered. Wetting his lips, he said, "Gus, Frank, the four new ones are yours. Break your sections off and go get 'em."
"Hot damn, skipper," Gus responded.
"Yeah, man," Frank exclaimed.
Jacob watched the four Hellcats at his rear break away and begin to climb. Then he concentrated on the six enemy aircraft directly ahead and below him. Moment by moment, they were becoming more sharply defined. Three were Vals, the others were Zeros. Were they all on kamikaze missions? Were the Zeros escorting kamikaze Vals to dogfight? He flicked his master armament switch on, and charging his 6 50-caliber machine guns, he felt the thud as rounds were chambered. Barreling down at the lead Val, he saw the red rising sun insignia growing larger. The air screamed past the Hellcat's canopy. Jacob's right forefinger rested lightly on the trigger. So far, he and his men, coming out of the sun, seemed to be undetected. He flicked his eyes to the altimeter. He was rushing toward 10,000 feet.
"Open out and pick your targets," he radioed to his pilots.
Glancing over his right shoulder, he saw his 8 planes string out behind him. Suddenly, the last Val in the lead group peeled off to the right and began to dive.
"They've spotted us,"
Vinny called as the Val formation broke up and scattered.
"It's a free-for-all now,"
Jacob radioed back, following the Val in front of him as it twisted and turned. For a few seconds, the meatball on the Japanese aircraft hung in his gun sight. Jacob fired a long burst. Smoke spurted from the engine of the enemy plane, and it rolled and plunged toward the sea. Jacob followed in hot pursuit.
"Skipper, you got a nip zero on your tail," Carl warned. "He's coming up under you."
Jacob kicked the plane over into a right turn. Without warning, he heard the thwacking sounds of machine gun bullets chewing into the metal skin of his Hellcat. Forgetting the Val, he pushed the stick forward and dived more steeply toward the sea. The altimeter needles rapidly unwound. At 7,000 feet, he pulled back hard on the stick. The force of 6 G's drove him down into the seat. His vision blurred. For what seemed an eternity, he floated in a hazy, semi-conscious state. Slowly, his vision cleared, and he realized he was over the top of a loop. He rolled into an Immelmann turn and found himself within range of the attacking Zero's tail. He instinctively squeezed the stick trigger, and as his tracers smothered the Zero, it exploded into 1,000 fragments.
"Jesus, Skipper," Steve called. "I got another one," Bill shouted. "I got the bastard."
Jacob saw a burning Val plummet toward the sea.
"You sure as hell did,"
he answered, scanning the sky for another target.
"Skipper, it's Frank. I'm hit,"
Jacob heard in his earphones as the melee developed.
"I'm hurt bad. Can't move my arms. Can't control this mother. Christ, help me."
"I don't see you, Frank. Can you get back to the ship? Is your wingman with you?"
Jacob radioed.
"Negative. We got separated,"
Frank responded with panic in his voice.
"I'm going to try to get out now."
"Red Rover, Red Rover, this is Red Leader. Red 10 is wounded. He's trying to bail out. Alert one of the destroyers."
"Can he come close to Red Rover?" the fighter director asked.
"Negative. Frank's in a spin, Skipper. I'm closing on him,"
Gus shouted. Jacob still did not have Red 10 in sight.
"He's not getting out. Holy mother of God, he's gone,"
Gus exclaimed with an infuriated sob.
"I'm going after the bastard Zero that got him."
"Red Rover, this is Red Leader,"
Jacob said, swallowing hard before he spoke.
"Red 10 went down. Red 8 saw him go in."
Jacob suddenly spotted a Val at 3 o'clock low and kicked his Hellcat over to the right. White streamers of tracers floated up toward him. The Japanese rear gunner was firing long bursts. Jacob bored in on the enemy plane with renewed vengeance. Once he had him in his gun sight, his six machine guns hammered. The white lines of his tracers seemed to wrap themselves around the fuselage of the Val. Jacob stopped firing and pulled back on the stick. His Hellcat angled up and over the plane.
"You got him, Skipper," Vinny called. "Black smoke is pouring out of his engine."
Jacob banked slightly to the left and looked back over his shoulder. The Val exploded into a ball of fire.
"Skipper," Gus called. "Two Vals going in on the deck. I can't catch them."
"Red Rover, two kamikazes from the second group incoming on the deck," Jacob radioed. "The first are no longer a problem."
"That's bad news and good news. We're ready. Stand clear."
Within moments, Jacob saw puffs of smoke erupting from the guns of the American ships steaming off the coast, and the sky around them turned black with deadly anti-aircraft fire.
"Vinny, guard your ass! There's a Zero behind you!" someone frantically called.
Jacob swiveled his head and spotted the Zero closing on a Hellcat. He threw his Hellcat into a tight left turn, and the Zero came broadside into his sights. He pressed the trigger, and tracers enveloped the enemy plane. He saw the pilot attempt to turn toward him. He fired another short burst. The pilot slumped in the cockpit. The plane suddenly swung off to the right, and Jacob watched the Zero go in a long, smoking glide. It smashed into a hill just behind the beach. Jacob then knew the Zero pilots were escorts for the kamikaze Vals and had been ready to fight them through. But it had not been a good day for the Japanese pilots.
"Skipper," Vinny radioed. "Looks like one of our ships has been hit."
Jacob looked toward the amphibious force. A thick column of black smoke was climbing into the sky. At least one of the Vals had managed to complete an attack.
"Red Rover," Jacob called. "This is Red Leader. My sky seems to be clear of bogeys. I know five have been splashed, maybe six."
His shirt was soaked with sweat as he looked at his watch. He'd been in the air for less than an hour.
"Good show, Red Leader," the fighter director responded. "Return to Red Rover and take up Combat Air Patrol Station until Charlie time. About 1 hour."
"Wilco," Jacob answered.
Hearing the weariness in his voice, he said to his men,
"Join up. Let's go home."
He made a wide turn and headed toward the Shiloh. On the way back, Jacob had time to reflect. This was his second combat tour in the Western Pacific. He'd served aboard the carrier Endeavor and had taken part in the strikes against the Japanese bases in the Gilbert and Marshall Islands and fought in the Battle of Midway. He'd been shot down once and had been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross with several gold stars. Now, at 26, he felt like an old man. The war was grinding away at him. He, along with his pilots, was dog-tired and weary. These past 2 weeks off Okinawa had sapped his vigor as nothing else had, and once the island was taken and secured, he knew the invasion of Japan itself would begin. If the toll in taking Okinawa was any indication, the cost in terms of men and equipment would be staggering. Jacob spotted the Shiloh and its escorts ahead of him. He assumed his cap station at 10,000 feet and circled at slow speed to conserve fuel. As the sun sank toward the horizon, the Shiloh radioed,
"Red Leader, this is Red Rover. Your signal, Charlie."
With a wave of relief, Jacob let his flight down into a holding circle at 1,000 feet. At 200 feet, he peeled off and entered the landing pattern. He lowered his landing gear and flaps, locked his shoulder harness, and as he entered the crosswind leg of his approach to the fantail, he picked up the landing signal officer's orange paddles, signaling a slight correction to the right. Jacob made the necessary adjustment so that the orange paddles were straight out on either side of the LSO's body. At the cut point over the ship's fantail, the LSO made a precise slashing movement across his chest with the right paddle. Jacob cut the throttle and flared for a landing. The plane touched down and rolled forward. An instant later, its hook grabbed an arresting wire and the Hellcat jerked to a stop. His shoulder harness held him from being thrown forward into the instrument panel. Jacob slid the wing-locking lever forward, allowing the plane handlers to push the plane's wings back into a folded position, and the yellow-jerseyed taxi directors led him toward the other parked planes on the forward part of the flight deck. For several moments, Jacob remained in the plane, too tired to move. The plane captain clambered up to the cockpit.
"You okay, Skipper?"
he asked, peering closely at Jacob's face.
"Beat to shit," Jacob answered, unbuckling his harness and then his chute. "Yeah, the Japs keep coming and we keep shooting them down, but they still keep coming."
Jacob lifted himself out of the cockpit, found the tow holds in the side of the aircraft, and dropped to the deck.
"Looks like you caught a few rounds," the plane captain said,
pointing to the rough-edged tears in the right wing. Jacob eyed the holds. He'd forgotten that he'd been hit.
"Nothing serious," he said.
"Just holes," the man said.
"I'll make sure they're patched up tonight."
"Thanks," Jacob said, and started to walk to the ready room, where he'd be debriefed when the klaxon screamed,
"All hands topside, take cover, inbound enemy aircraft."
The all-too-familiar voice ordered over the flight deck address system. One of Jacob's pilots was on his final approach, and three others were still in the air. He looked at the yardarms. The Fox flags were being hauled down.
"He's being waved off," the plane captain shouted as he ran for cover.
At full throttle, the Hellcat roared over the Shiloh's flight deck and pulled up. Jacob looked up at the unrecovered planes. They didn't have much fuel remaining, 30 minutes at the most. Not enough for further combat, and they would be ordered, no doubt, to clear the area.
Incoming bogeys, bearing 054 relative, range 8 miles, Angels 2, the 1MC blared.
The four Fighting Eight planes turned to the left and headed away from the Shiloh to a carrier in another task group where they could be recovered. The ship's guns were now the only defense. Rather than go to the ready room, Jacob remained topside to see the show. In a jaundiced way, he had concluded that if you weren't in the air, it really didn't matter whether he died on the flight deck or in the ready room in an attack. For the past 2 weeks at sunset, after fighter cover was no longer in the air, Japanese Bettys, Louis the Lamplighters as they were known, had bored in at low level for suicidal torpedo attacks. Suddenly, the ships on the outer perimeter of the Shiloh screen erupted with a barrage of anti-aircraft fire.
Incoming bogey, 050 degrees, low on the water, 1 mile.
The escort ships on the Shiloh's starboard side were firing with furious intensity as a twin-engine Betty skimmed the surface and headed for the Shiloh. The carrier was heeled over to starboard, responding to hard left rudder. Then her guns opened up. The noise was deafening. Black smoke poured out of the Betty's port engine, but it kept coming. Its right wing began to shred and break away from the fuselage, making it pitch violently to the right. For an instant, Jacob was sure the plane would fall short of the ship. But the very next moment, its remains slammed into the Shiloh's starboard side, within a few yards of the fantail, below the level of the flight deck, and into a 40-millimeter mount, where it exploded into a ball of fire. Within seconds, the unreleased torpedo it carried in its open bay exploded underwater, showering debris in all directions. Jacob ran toward the stricken gun mount. Damage control firefighters were already battling the inferno. One of the men in the gun crew was screaming in agony as he staggered out of the smoke and flames. His clothing was charred and seared flesh peeled from his arms.
"I'm blind," he yelled.
Blood gushed from his mouth. His knees gave way and he dropped to the deck.
"Incoming bogey," the 1MC blared. "Bearing 045 relative, range 4 miles, low on the water."
The ship screening the Shiloh once again opened fire on the inbound enemy plane, but it, like the first one, kept boring in despite the intensity of the fire. Just as it passed over an outlying destroyer, Jacob saw it. It, too, was headed straight for the Shiloh's starboard side when, in a hail of gunfire, it lost altitude and plowed into the water. Its wings broke off as it tumbled across the water and disappeared below the waves. The Shiloh remained at general quarters until 2000, when the fire in the after starboard section of the ship was finally extinguished. Damage control parties started making temporary repairs. The physical damage caused by the Betty attack was relatively minor, and at 0800 the following morning, Jacob's pilots returned to the Shiloh. Throughout the day, he and his men were once again flying combat air patrol for the ship. On the morning of April 16, 1945, Commander Warren Troost sat before the desk of Captain George Munson aboard the attack transport Iroquois, the flagship of Amphibious Task Group 56.6, where tactical planning for the invasion of Okinawa by Marine Assault Forces was being completed.
"Ordinarily," Captain Munson said, "a job like this might be given to a sub. But all of ours are now otherwise engaged, and Admiral Harley, in special operations back at Pearl, suggested you and your PT boats for the task."
Troost, a solidly built young man with blue eyes, brown hair, and sensuous lips, studied the captain. Less than an hour before, he had radioed Warren to report to the flagship.
"Sir, you haven't told me what the mission is."
Munson took out a silver cigarette case, opened it, offered a cigarette to Warren.
"No, thank you, sir. I'm a pipe man myself."
Munson nodded. Taking a cigarette from the case, he tapped the end of it against the cover of the case before he lit it.
"We know there's a Japanese prison ship hiding in a cove in one of the Amami Islands in the central Ryukyus."
He opened a manila folder, removed three glossy 8x10 aerial photographs, and showed them to Warren.
"These were taken just 72 hours ago. As part of the Okinawa campaign, we're planning to capture the ship, take it to sea, and rescue the prisoners."
Somewhat startled, Warren examined the photographs. On each, a white circle and a red one had been overlaid. A small, box-like ship was clearly visible inside the white circle. Several buildings, which Warren guessed were some sort of prison camp or a defense headquarters, possibly both, were included in the red one.
"You'd have to get in and out fast," Munson said.
Warren shifted his gaze from the photographs to the captain.
"Getting in fast wouldn't be a problem, but getting out, well, that will be a different matter if I'm to take that ship to sea."
"Getting the ship out is the essence of the operation," Munson responded blandly, blowing smoke toward the ceiling.
"Obviously, unless you do, we won't be able to rescue the prisoners."
Warren smiled wryly.
"Sir, I see what you mean, but getting out fast, is that realistic? If that barge makes 10 knots, we'll be lucky. But first there's the matter of capturing her. What's going to be involved in that?"
"We estimate a 30 to 40 member crew."
"That's 3 to 4 times the size of one of mine, and there'll be at least that many troops in that base."
Munson nodded.
"Could be," he said. "But you'll have 2 dozen really mean Marines with you."
"How many of my boats go?"
2, yours and one other. Once you take the ship, you'll move her out to sea and rendezvous with the destroyer Ferris that will tow your boats to within 50 miles of the island to begin with."
"And our boats?"
"Totally expendable," Munson answered. "Once you take possession of the Jap ship, you'll destroy them."
Warren tried not to show his surprise. He'd been in PTs since 42 and loved them. The idea of destroying his own boats didn't sit well.
"After this mission," Munson said matter-of-factly, "you're going to be reassigned."
"You mean my squadron will..."
Munson shook his head.
"PTs will be phased out. You're headed for a more important slot."
He smiled.
"I probably wasn't supposed to tell you anything about that plan, but I'm sure I can rely on your discretion."
"Of course you can, sir," Warren answered simply,
though he wasn't sure he liked what he'd been told. He liked the freewheeling independence that he had in the PTs.
"Captain James Connolly will be the Marine Platoon commander. First Lieutenant Clifford W. Dawson will be his second. There will be 2 experienced gunnery sergeants and the rest combat veteran EMs," Munson explained. "Their job will be to neutralize enemy opposition. After you leave the Ferris, you will be in overall command."
"Have you any charts of the cove?" Warren asked.
"None that are modern," Munson answered,
stubbing out his cigarette in a metal ashtray.
The PTs have a shallow enough draft to bring them close inshore without any difficulty, Warren said. But maneuvering a ship,
she's about the same size as AKO-96, and as I recall, you did well with her.
Warren flushed. In the early days of the war, he had become skipper of the 96, a one-of-a-kind combination oiler and supply ship after its captain and executive officer had been killed.
Well enough with her, Munson repeated, to bring her safely to Pearl and get yourself a Navy Cross for doing it.
Warren felt his cheeks burning. Despite the fact he was young to be a full commander, he was a quiet, self-effacing man. The horrors of war had developed a degree of humility in his approach to life.
The Ferris will take you, and whatever other boat you choose to go with you, in tow at 0330 on April 18th. Should the previous day's aerial reconnaissance indicate that the ship was moved, the mission will be scrubbed. The same will hold true up until the morning of the attack. You will be advised whether or not to proceed with the mission, which has been codenamed Operation Cutout.
How many prisoners are aboard the ship? Warren asked.
We don't know.
Will any of the prisoners be ashore?
Again, we don't know.
Assuming we are successful in seizing and getting the ship to sea,
where the Ferris will escort you back here, where the prisoners will be transferred to one of our ships and be sent to either Perth or Pearl. A decision where to send them won't be made until we know how many are involved and where they are from. That really is not your problem.
Warren nodded. That was clear, but as far as he was concerned, it was the only aspect of the scheme that was clear.
Have you any questions? Munson asked.
When do I get to meet Captain Connolly and Lieutenant Dawson? Warren asked.
Munson looked at his watch. They should be coming aboard just about now. It's up to you to plan the details with them.
Reporting as ordered, sir, Lieutenant Commander Glenn Lascom said, looking down at Commander Harold Ross, the Ferris's skipper, who was seated behind a small desk in his sea cabin.
Ross leaned back in his chair and, without inviting Glenn to sit down, said,
I found something for you to do while you're waiting for your new orders. I don't like to see an officer sitting around doing nothing, even if he is a hero.
Glenn stiffened. A few days before, a kamikaze had sunk his ship, and after being rescued by a PT boat skippered by his old friend Warren Troost, he had been temporarily assigned to the Ferris. Commander Ross, learning of Glenn's combat background and heroism, had taken an instant, jealous dislike to him.
We're being detached from the task group to rendezvous with two PT boats and take part in a highly classified rescue mission. You will be my liaison officer with the PT attack unit. You will accompany them to their objective and radio me when and if the job is completed. Otherwise, for the protection of this ship, strict radio silence will be maintained, regardless of the situation ashore. Is that understood?
Yes, sir, Glenn answered. He was a tall, blond, handsome man with blue-gray eyes and an easy smile, who had been decorated several times for conspicuous gallantry and bravery in action.
Have you any questions? Ross asked perfunctorily.
Three, sir.
Ross scowled.
Ask, he answered.
He was a short man with a round face and small green eyes.
Where are the people we're going to rescue? Who are they? And when will this mission take place?
Ross leaned forward and placed his elbows on the desk.
We're scheduled to depart at 0300 the day after tomorrow. For now, that's as much as you need to know.
Yes, sir, Glenn answered. Is there anything else, sir?
He asked, purposely assuming the demeanor of a young, inexperienced officer in the presence of a god. Ross's full cheeks colored. Glenn looked straight at him.
Nothing, Ross finally answered.
Glenn saluted, did a smart about-face, and left the captain's cabin. But as soon as he was outside, he slammed his fist into the palm of his other hand and muttered,
What a turd bird.
Chapter 2
After an uneventful air patrol, Jacob taxied smartly out of the Shiloh's arresting gear into his parking spot.
over the noise of the wind and the clatter and roar of other aircraft in his flight being recovered and taxied, Jacob heard the powerful flight deck bull.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?